06-1393, Cordis Corporation against Medtronic et al. Mr. Underhill?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're first.
May it please the Court. In my 6 minutes, I'd like to address two issues. The first is that the District Court did not grant JMOL of non-infringement. And I want to clarify that we're only talking literal infringement in this case. Cordis did not put on a DOE case. My second issue, we believe we're entitled to a new trial on obviousness in light of KSR. I'd like to start with infringement. The District Court did not follow this Court's teachings in AVE1 concerning substantial uniform thickness. Had it done so, it would have found, as a matter of law, that the walls of Medtronic stents do not have a substantial uniform thickness from end to end.
I read over that. Of course, we're fortunate in having the author of that opinion presiding here.
Perhaps not.
But I didn't see anything in there. And that paragraph that you rely on that indicated that we were saying this is how you must determine thickness. It seemed to me the principal issue, as I read it, was whether or not you could read into the claim a numerical limitation, and the court said you couldn't. And then the court went on to say, well, now what are we talking about the walls of these things? And it gave a sort of a hypothetical example, and you seem to me to be arguing that in doing that we somehow prescribed the method by which it was to be measured.
Your Honor, what we have here is a situation where the structure is completely undisputed. And this court has said repeatedly in at least 7 cases that where you have undisputed structure, the whole infringement inquiry collapses into one of law. It's essentially claim construction. One recent case on that is the MyMail decision, 476 F3rd at 1378, and there's 6 others. What we are talking about here is a question of law, not fact. And in the opinion, in the AVE1, this court said, second, according to the patent's claims, it is the wall surface that needs to have a uniform thickness, and the full circumference of the round strut is not involved in making up the wall surface. That's what the court said when they were talking about the strut. We completely accept that, we embrace it, it's right, you know, we go forward. We're talking now about the crown. The crown, the very tips of the crowns, which is what we're talking about here, most certainly is involved in making up the wall surface. And there is absolutely no doubt on that. Cordis's expert conceded at trial that that was the case. There was no disputing evidence. And I cite the court to the blue brief at 32.
Are you telling us that the jury should not have been permitted to determine whether they were of a uniform thickness?
That is exactly the point, Your Honor. We moved for JMOL at the end of the case. It should not have gone to the jury. This is not a jury question. This is a judge question. And what we have here is undisputed facts that the wall tapers at the ends. Let me address their main argument, which is, well, it's only 2%. Claim language says substantially uniform thickness. Therefore, it's only about 2%. We can ignore it. That's wrong. It's wrong because in the prosecution history, in the Lazarus case, which was addressed by the examiner, there was a finding by the examiner that these little teeny tiny staples, which occupied virtually no real estate on the Lazarus stent, were sufficient to take it outside of substantially uniform thickness. And the examiner statement is at page 46 of the blue brief. And perhaps more importantly, Dr. Collins, Cordis's expert at trial, admitted that Lazarus is not substantially uniform thickness because of the staples. Well, most certainly, if Lazarus is not substantially uniform thickness, the roundedness at the end of Medtronic's fence cannot possibly be substantially uniform thickness as well. The district court erred in several grounds, refused to give a jury instruction with respect to this court's instructions in ABE1. The court granted a motion in limine where our experts couldn't even explain that their testimony about the imaginary circles came from this court's decision, so they looked like idiots in closing when they were mocked for making up this wild theory. In my remaining time, Your Honor, we asked for a curative instruction at trial with respect to the abuse of the 100% holding. The variation at the ends is absolutely more than 100%. It goes from the diameter of the wall down to virtually zero. Clearly, more than 100%. Counsel conceded in the closing that there was a variation at the end. But he argued that there could never be 100% variation in a stent. His argument was, if you have a 3-inch stent, obviously I'm making up the dimension, you can never get down to zero, because if you get down to zero, it's no longer the stent. That was his argument. That's not what 100% means. Based on the prosecution history, based on what this court said, if it's 3 inches here and it goes to 1.5 inches here, that's 100%. Anytime there's double thickness or more, it's 100%. Now, if I may quickly address the obviousness issue, the law changed on us during this case. The jury instruction in this case was a flat-footed, rigid application of the TSM test. That is exactly what KSR said is now appropriate. There is substantial prejudice in this case for several reasons. First,
did you object to the jury
instruction? We did not object, Your Honor. We've put the case law in our brief. Since then, we've collected, I think, 3 other cases, the 7th, the 9th, and the 10th, and the 2nd, all said you don't have to object when the law changes. We found no law on the other side of that issue. It is prejudicial. We're dealing with a mechanical patent here, very simple patent, very easy to understand. We're dealing with prior art that is extremely close, and obviously we think invalidating. We have the Ursic patent, which teaches essentially a stent of the 762. We have the Hammerschlag patent, which teaches balloon expandability and intraluminal delivery. It is a slam dunk. It's common sense to combine those. But the jury in this case was specifically told that unless there was an express teaching of TSM, the jury could not combine.
Do you think, is the burden of your argument that every obviousness case that was tried under the pre-Supreme Court decision would be presumptively reversible absent a showing of harmless error?
Absolutely not. And let me tell you why, Your Honor. In this case, enormous amounts of time was put into arguing to the jury about whether or not the references could or could not be combined. And I do have some record sites.
That, in any case in which obviousness is contested seriously, that's going to be what you're arguing.
That's one point, Your Honor. If I may give you the site, though, because they're not in the brief, it's the appendix at 5585 and the appendix at 5528 to 29. This is where there was the battle, you know, in the closing arguments on whether or not they could or could not be combined. To answer your question, this is a simple mechanical case. That's important under KSR. It's an extremely high standard for the one of ordinary skill in the art. And this is very unusual in this case. In this case, one of ordinary skill in the art is a highly skilled physician working with a highly skilled engineer. So it's a very high level of ordinary skill.
By the way, we're not going to hold you strictly to your time. So I'm sensing some nervousness there.
Yes, okay.
We will definitely preserve your full time. And
he's very generous. He told me to take as much of his time as I want.
That was my guess. Very well. Please proceed.
But you say that if there had not been such an instruction, it's at least highly likely that the case would have come out the other way. Is that right?
Indeed, Your Honor. I don't see how it could have come out any differently. If we look at the art, let's talk about the 984 patent. The 984 patent is subsequent to the 762. The 762 is prior art. The stent elements in 762 are exactly the stent elements of the 984. No doubt, you know, no question about it. It's all conceded. The only thing that added in the 984 was a straight little connector bar that connected the two elements together so they didn't kind of float off. That connector bar already existed in the prior art. It existed with the connected Z-stents. And we've referred, for example, to the Wallace article, but it was all over the prior art. People have been using these connected Z-stents forever. So the whole invention of the 984, and believe me, I don't think this is the slightest bit disputed, is you take that little connector member, you stick it in between the two, and voila, we have the 984. The 762 is almost that simple. The 762, the Ursic patent, predated by, you know, two decades. Ursic patent is a stent, but instead of it being balloon expanded, it was not. It was expanded with a little expander device, a mechanical device. But balloon angioplasty was known by the time of the invention, and the Hammerschlag patent is prior art. Hammerschlag is the use of a balloon to expand a stent. So again, what is simpler than you stick the balloon inside Ursic and voila, you know, you have the 762 patent. So if there is any case, you know, that screams for an opportunity to be heard by a fact finder, when, you know, you have this close of art, I mean, this is this case. If there's any case that should ever be remanded, you know, for a KSR, it's this case. I do know that the court has already remanded one case to be reconsidered in light of KSR, and that is the Vonage case from last week, in which there was a remand and a request to the district court in the first instance to look at the KSR instruction. This is clearly a situation here, though, where it was an extremely flat-footed instruction, and I read to the court, if the prior art references as a whole do not teach, suggest, or motivate that combination, then they may not be combined. That was the instruction below. And that's not KSR. What KSR teaches is that it may be a factor, that it's not dispositive. And if the instruction is read as a whole, the entire, you know, instruction with respect to obviousness, one cannot help but come away with the idea that there has been an incorrect jury instruction, which most certainly affected the jury's outcome.
Very well. I think we have your argument. Why don't we reserve your rebuttal time, and we'll give your co-counsel his full time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well. Mr. DeMurray.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the indulgence. May it please the court, John Damaris for Boston Scientific. At the outset, I think it's important to note this is Boston Scientific's first trip to the Court of Appeals. Although we've had two trials, that was due to the judge giving us a new trial on a specific issue, and this is our first time here to address all the issues. And our issues are very different from Medtronic's issues. The first one I'd like to address, which was not briefed by Medtronic in its first appeal or in this one, is the claim term wall surface. In the first trial that we had, the district court erred very clearly under the current law when she allowed the jury to consider the doctrinal equivalence for a wall surface. In her JMOL decision, Judge Robinson found that there was, in the prosecution here, the Cordis disclaimed the wall surfaces that didn't have a common cylindrical plane. In the district court's words in the JMOL decision, the Ursec prior art reference had twisting members coming out of the cylindrical circumference, and Cordis, the applicant, told the patent office, our wall surface has to be in a common cylindrical plane. As a result, the court put those terms into the literal construction. So wall surface took Cordis' statements from the prosecution history and read that common cylindrical plane into the literal construction. Nonetheless, the district court then, when considering doctrine of equivalence, admittedly, the court said it was confused about the law. I think if you read the JMOL decision at A290 to 291, the district court said negotiating the boundaries between what is a disclaimer and what is prosecution history estoppel is puzzling, the court said. But this court's jurisdiction is not puzzling. There are several cases, including the Cordis AVE case that was appealed earlier in this very action, where the court said the test for prosecution disclaimer, which leads to literal construction, and argument estoppel, which bars doctrine of equivalence, is the same test. and the court referred to the Omega Engineering case, and that has been the law here. It's not puzzling. It's quite clear. If you're going to have a prosecution disclaimer that limits the literal interpretation of the claim, like we did here, that is the same test for argument estoppel to limit doctrine of equivalence. So what happened here? The district court did a prosecution disclaimer and interpreted wall surface to have to be in a common cylindrical plane. Cordes does not appeal that instruction here at this appeal, but then the district court allowed the jury to consider whether you could have doctrine of equivalence to that common cylindrical plane, thus vitiating the literal construction and the literal disclaimer, totally undoing what was the whole point of the prosecution disclaimer, and it's in violation of this court's settled precedent on that issue. And Cordes doesn't take issue with the fact that if doctrine of equivalence should not have gone to the jury, then under Litton and United Pilots, we are entitled to, at a minimum, a new trial on the issue of whether there is a wall surface in a common cylindrical plane as a matter of literal infringement. But we don't even need a new trial here because the evidence about how the stent is constructed is undisputed. In our stent, when you go from end to end and look at the exterior surface, our experts and our fact witnesses testify that at the U's, there are these straight portions and then U portions. Those U's, when you make the stent, pop out of the cylindrical surface of the stent. 19% of the U's pop out more than 100%. Some of them up to 125%.
This raises the question that's puzzling to me, and maybe it's very clear. I'm sure it's clear to you, and you can help.
I hope so.
Well, I'm sure it is. At the first trial, the focus was on the tubular member being, for lack of a better term, the segment in between the U's.
That was one of Cordes' positions.
Right.
It wasn't their own position.
Okay,
they
but in any event, if there had been found, that segment had been found to be infringing, then that would be sufficient a sufficient predicate for infringement, as I understood their position for his trial.
That was Cordes' position. We disagree with that.
Well, I understand.
Well.
That was their position. Now, if I understand correctly, the Cordes changed its position in the second trial to say that the tubular member now extends to incorporate at least one of the U shape.
In the second trial, they conceded that it had to be the whole stent.
The whole stent.
So,
right.
We don't even know if any one jury.
But of course, whole stent can be presumably short. But I gather that the concession extended to at least one U shaped device.
Well, yes, we have
all
several
right.
of them on any one stent.
Okay,
that, right,
right.
Exactly. But the issue there is that this patent cannot be read. Just to pick up on that point before I go to my next, this patent cannot be read. That the tubular member would be one of those sections. We call it a C section because they look like C's. For several reasons. Number one, the claim requires the tubular member to be elongated, which is substantially longer in the longitudinal than in the circumferential. When you look at those rings, they're essentially square, so it wouldn't meet tubular member. Secondly, nowhere in the patent does it say one of those C sections could be the tubular member. There's only one section of the patent that even mentions rings. It was added during re-exam, and they added a section of the specification called the ring portion. But even in that section of the spec, it says the ring portion is a portion of the tubular member. So their only disclosure of a ring itself defines it as a portion of the tubular member. And the tubular member, if you wanted to call that C-section in our stent, a tubular member, it wouldn't be elongated. I think that was a theory that Cordes realized the problems with, and they abandoned it, and in the second trial they didn't even pursue it. So that's another reason, frankly, why the first trial is tainted. But even if the first trial, even if the first jury relied...
Well, you haven't raised that point.
It's actually in our brief where we say that they shouldn't have been able to read on the ring portion. I don't know that we then reached the conclusion that the first trial was therefore tainted. That was...
Oh, I didn't see
it. We did... brief the issue about the ring portion shouldn't be subject to these claims. But this wall surface issue actually permeated the problem in the second trial as well. So what happened in the first trial is wall portion goes to the jury under literal and doctrine of equivalence. And they come back, they don't find literal, they find doctrine of equivalence infringement. The judge gives us a retrial on the next limitation I want to talk about, which is substantially uniform thickness. In the retrial, so now we've got a jury trying to figure out whether our stent has a substantial uniform thickness. And what happens at the trial, the jury sends out a note and says, well, what's the wall surface? What does it mean to be disposed in a common cylindrical plane? What they're grappling with is what is it you're supposed to measure? And this is, I think, one of the key things that we're mixing up in this case. The claim requires the wall surface to have a substantially uniform thickness. And the jury in the second case asked the district judge, what is the wall surface? What does it mean to be disposed in a common cylindrical plane? She didn't answer the question.
Well, she said it's irrelevant, didn't she?
Exactly, and that's where the problem comes in. There is no dispute between the parties about the measurements. This isn't a case about how do you measure the dimensions. They pursued at the second trial a theory that the thickness of our metal was the wall thickness, regardless of the orientation of the struts and whether they stayed in the cylindrical plane or not. We pursued a different theory, and we showed, following this court's decision in ABB1, the earlier appeal, we put an imaginary cylinder on the center of the stent, and we measured radially outward to the outermost portion of the outer wall to determine what the thickness was. We thought we were following your earlier decision, and we presented the jury with those measurements. Now, neither side took issue with each other's measurements. We didn't say they measured our metal wrong. They didn't say we made radial measurements wrong. There's no dispute about how the products work. The cases are legion from this court that means this is a claim construction issue. What should we be measuring is a claim construction.
This is where, and this is the reason I asked the question earlier, this is where I start to get a little confused. Let me ask the question this way. At page 21519 of the appendix, and this is in Cordes' response in opposition to BSC's motions in limine, Cordes states that the parties are now in agreement for the purpose of this trial, the 2005 trial, that the NIR stent as a whole meets the limitations in claim 23 of the 762 patent that require a tubular member having a wall surface. So when the jury comes back and asks about wall surface, why isn't it legitimate for the trial court to say that issue is not before you?
It's a good question, and it was what we struggled with the district court trying to explain there as well, which is the first jury found wall surface either literally or by equivalence. In fact, they found it by equivalence. By not telling the second jury...
Do we know, by the way, that they found it by equivalence, or do we simply know that they found infringement by equivalence, and we don't know what limitation they may have found by equivalence?
They checked no literal infringement for overall, and they checked doctrinal equivalence.
But there wasn't a special verdict in which they checked DOE for this limitation.
Okay. Exactly. But
I understand your argument.
We did not admit literal infringement. By the district court not telling the jury that there's a difference, the jury now, the second jury in 2005, is getting instruction from the judge that the parties agree there's a wall surface. That's not exactly right. The parties agreed that we weren't contesting that element in this second trial because the first jury had met it literally or by equivalence. And by equivalence matters because if there is a wall surface, the jury's going to think that the only thing they need to measure is the metal, like Cordes did.
But
and
I,
it follows because they
you,
deliberated for 2 days and then came back right after the question.
I suppose you would say that since the jury has to decide whether the wall surface has a substantially uniform thickness, how can it do that unless it first knows what the wall surface is? That is, you can't measure something unless you know what you're measuring. What are we supposed to measure? What's the wall surface? And the judge said to them, that's irrelevant.
That's exactly my point, Your Honor. And it's a matter of law. It is a claim construction issue as to what the parties should have been measuring. We weren't disputing the products. We weren't disputing how they were made. We weren't disputing the measurements. We were just disputing what is we're supposed to be measuring. But I got to get back to this, and this is the reason why it's a matter of law. In the prosecution history, Cordes disclaimed the measurements that they advocated to the jury in 2005. Here's what happened. ERSEC, the prior art, was made from a flat sheet where they cut slits in it, they rolled it into a cylinder, and they welded it. Our near stent is made from a flat sheet. We cut the openings in it, we roll it, and we weld it. The reason that's significant is in ERSEC, in the prior art, when you cut first and then roll, the members pop out of the circumference. In our near stent, When you cut the openings and roll, the members pop out of the cylindrical surface. Why is this important? The examiner rejected this very claim by saying, because the metal thickness that Ursek started with was the same, when you rolled it and the members popped out of the cylinder, is irrelevant. Therefore, the patent claim is not going to issue. Cordes responds in the prosecution history and says, that is absolutely wrong, examiner. The twisting of the members out of the cylindrical plane, in Cordes' words, is, quote, the antithesis of substantially uniform thickness, close quote. That's at A2051, and they say it again at 2045. They say antithesis in 2051. They say the twisting out of the plane of the members is the antithesis of a substantially uniform thickness. Then at the trial, they argue just the opposite. And they tell the jury, it doesn't matter if these things twist out of the plane. It's the thickness of the metal. In fact, they mocked us for telling the jury that that was important. We asked the district court to prevent them from doing that, to hold them to the prosecution, and the district court did not. And therefore, that's where we are. So the combination of wall surface, with the jury not being told what they were supposed to measure, and with Cordes talking exactly opposite to what they told the examiner to the jury, totally prejudiced the second trial on substantially uniform thickness.
I have one other question, and then I think we have to move on. We've given you a fair amount of extra time here, unless you have something to... What were you going to say? I won't cut you off before you tell me what you were going to say.
I do think there is a very important issue relating to slots, and if you could give me 30 seconds,
okay.
I can do it. But right. You had a question first?
Well, let me ask this question because it pertains to the last issue.
Okay.
In the jury instructions, and I believe this is the 2005 trial, in fact, I'm sure it is, 22706, the court instructed on wall surface. And instructed with the language, the outer surface of the tubular member must be disposed in a common cylindrical plane.
Yes.
Why did she instruct on that issue, since it sounds like that was exactly what had been conceded on that limitation?
Was that a mistake? It did nothing but confuse the jury. But the jury.
Well,
had
that's
to be told
see,
something.
That's my question because right. if that didn't belong in there, then why was she wrong to say? This is not a matter of concern for you when they raised a question that seemed to be directed exactly at that instruction.
Let me explain. What the jury needed to be told was what are we to measure?
But that isn't the question they asked.
They did, though, because the claim says it's the wall surface that has to have a substantially uniform thickness.
I understand that.
So they come out with a question saying, what is this wall surface?
Right.
What does it mean to be
in a plane? But if we read, where I'm going with this is, if we read the jury's question as being directed at the instruction I just read, and if...
I think it was, actually.
And if that instruction had been effectively conceded away, that instruction looks like a basis on which the jury could find non-infringement because of this wall surface limitation not having been satisfied. If the court was correct in saying that that has been conceded, then why wasn't it equally correct for the court to say that limitation is not for you to consider?
What would they be measuring from? They had to grapple with what is a wall surface, right? I mean, the district court's conclusion, properly so, is the jury had to grapple with what is a wall surface. They shouldn't have had to, because the district court judge should have said, this is what you measure. If you do that properly, the infringement inquiry goes away.
Okay,
because
well,
there's no dispute about the measurements, and this court can solve the problem right now by saying, Cordes should not be able to measure the metal when it flares out, just like they told the patent office.
Okay, I have I understand your answer now.
30 seconds on slots, I think it's important.
Sure.
You decided in the AVE1 case, the term plurality of slots under the written description test. But there is a real problem when that construction is applied to the near stent. When you look at the near stent, it's in the briefs, you'll see that we have these big U sections. What Cordes does in order to apply slots to our stent is they arbitrarily divide that open space into three small segments. And they say, this little piece is substantially parallel. We're going to ignore the predominant piece, which is the dipping U, and then they look at the others, you know, and they're taking an integral single piece of our product and they're arbitrarily slicing it up. And when you look at this court's prior decision in AVE1 that says a slot is just an open space, it can be half slots or full slots, it doesn't matter, and you see how that can be applied, and you can see the mischief it can do by looking at the near stent and having courts chop it up into little pieces arbitrarily. If that were the way patent law was supposed to happen, that you can take an integral product and chop it up into little pieces, you could find any cylindrical tube is going to infringe this patent, and that's not what this patent is about. So the construction should be modified in some way either to say that a complete slot bound on all sides has to be part of a plurality of slots, or there needs to be some provision that the application of that claim onto products has to take account of the entirety of the open space in the stent. So in our near stent, they would have to account for the entirety of the open space, and it's that open space that would have to be substantially parallel.
Very well. Thank you. We'll hear from Mr. Discant next. Mr. Cordes.
May it please the court. My name is Greg Discant for Cordes. Judge Bryson, Judge Friedman, it's really good to see you. Today is October 3, 2007, and it marks the 10th anniversary of the filing of this lawsuit. October 3, 1997, Cordes, proud owner of patented technology that was revolutionizing the treatment of science, brought...
But if I can interrupt for a moment, could you add, I think, about 12 minutes to Mr. Discant's time in the event that he needs it, just for fairness, because I think that's approximately the amount that we of extra time that we gave to the appellants. Go ahead.
I'll try not to use it. That would be great. We brought these cases because Cordes was creating a new industry in which it had invested a tremendous amount of money and had patent protection for, and the industry, by and large, ignored the patents and went into the market, and we have been suing them. And we have now won against these defendants in 2000. On appeal, this court said we won under an unduly narrow claim construction. The case was remanded. Those verdicts should have been reinstated, since if you won under an unduly narrow claim construction, you should, I win under a broader construction. Instead, we went through two more trials on infringement that were necessary, and we won again. We think it's time for these cases to be affirmed and for the case to move forward, and we're hoping that this court agrees. Let me briefly address AVE's points. There are two that were argued. One is on substantially uniform thickness, and the question is, was the cross-section of the stent, the strut, proof of uniform thickness? This court said it was in AVE1. Judge Bryson's decision says the thickness of the wall was equal to the diameter of each round strut. We're looking at the same structure, the same struts that went back and forth. It was a bent wire stent is an issue. The question was, if you took bent wire and made a stent out of it, could it be a substantially uniform thickness? Or could it not be a substantially uniform thickness because it had curved edges? It, of course, has curved edges all the way around. The court, to my reading, said yes, we could. We then had a retrial on this subject under the charge that came straight out of this court's opinion. The charge was the wall of the tubular member must be of largely or approximately uniform thickness. Wall that varies in thickness by as much as 100% cannot be said to be a substantially uniform thickness. AVE does not challenge the sufficiency of the evidence under that charge, and hardly could, since its own engineers repeatedly measured the thickness of the struts and what it now calls the crowns to differentiate it from struts, although many of those of skill in the art consider the entirety of the metal to be the strut. Frankly, think that's what the court was referring to. Be that as it may, the evidence was overwhelming that one of skill in the art measures the thickness of the struts and the crowns in the same way by taking the diameter of the widest part, and the measurements were uniform. The legal challenge on this appeal is, as I understand it, that there should have been an amendment to the claim construction to add to the claim construction a requirement that there be a particular method utilized in measuring the thickness, that the so-called concentric circles methodology be the judicially required method of measurement. As a matter of claim construction doctrine, I think that's utterly baseless. The intrinsic evidence of the 762 patent makes clear that the thickness of the wall surface is referred to simultaneously as the thickness of the elongate members that make up the wall. Figure 2 is shown in cross-section, and its uniform thickness is identified. It is plain that those of skill in the art who created the patent were measuring cross-sections, and it's also plain that there's no basis in the law to impose a particular measurement methodology. So the question was simply a fact question for trial. They brought in scientists who advocated a method of measurement. We brought in scientists who advocated a different one that was consistent with the evidence from ABE's own engineers. The jury found in our favor, and I think that should be the end of that issue.
Let me ask you this, and I think I now regret
your colorful analogy.
Yes, I think sometimes the less said is the better, and that applies maybe
with space
or courts of appeals. Maybe not. In any event, what I understood to be the case in the 2003 appeal was that at that time we were talking about the internal segment, not the U's, not including the U's.
We were talking about the ABE stent, which is different.
Right.
The ABE stent doesn't have U's. It has welds connecting the rings.
Right. Okay.
We were talking about the...
Well, I'm talking now about the problem of substantial, substantially, the walls being substantially uniformly thick.
Correct.
Which is the problem with the U's, right? I mean, that's... Isn't...
Are you talking about the BSC U's?
Yes. Right, I'm talking about the BSC.
It's not the problem with the BSC use, but...
Well, that's maybe I'm misunderstanding the argument, but the BSC says the U's extend out far enough that if you use the concentric circles or the imaginary circles analysis, you produce a wall that does not have uniform thickness.
No, actually, that's not true.
It's not true that that's an argument?
No, they're cheating on that.
But that's their argument, right?
No, it's not their argument. Because if that were their argument, then you would get, it would be exactly the same. If you took...
I see where you're going to go with this. You're going to say that if you take the concentric circle at the very tips of each of the U's all the way around and the concentric circle at the bottom, you end up with a definition of the wall that satisfies the imaginary circles.
That's exactly right. Or you have a different choice. You don't have to think about it that way if you want to pursue this analogy. And I'm not sure this analogy... Well, let me just stay with the analogy. If you wanted to define the outside surface, and if you wanted to say, for sake of argument, that the outside surface of the near has irregularities in it if you include the U's, so that the outside surface goes straight in the C portions, it goes up, it goes straight, it goes up. Okay, so now we have an outside surface that's irregular, and let's run a circle, with just bands of circles around it each time. So now we have surrounded that structure with a series of circles. What will you do on the inside? On the inside, you do the same thing. You create circles that match the metal. And the inside circles would go up and down, just as the outside circles did. And so it's your goal. In your example, you had circles that touched the metal from end to end. If you had circles that touched the metal from end to end in the Boston stent, then you have a wall surface that's of exactly uniform thickness from end to end. What they have done is they have a bottom imaginary circle and no imaginary circle on the top.
Well, I understand. They would say, I think, that the imaginary circle doesn't take into account you don't run the imaginary circle around the very tips of the U's as you go up.
But
let me ask you this question, because this goes to the heart of at least my confusion on this. What we had in front of us in 2003 was the version of what the trial judge had said has to be found with respect to these stent tubular members, which is that they have to be, and we said this in the opinion, they have to be disposed in a common cylindrical plane.
Yeah.
Now that certainly seems to apply to the subset sections, but not including the U's.
Then the question.
Right? Is that so far so good?
If you're talking about...
I'm talking about the BSC.
Yes, for the BSC near.
Right.
For the BSC near, there is a perfect cylindrical plane around the rings.
Right.
And we have not disclaimed that as part of our theory.
Well, that's where I'm going, because that was the theory I understood to be the theory of infringement in the first trial, and that's the theory that we were addressing in the imaginary circles, because it seems to me the imaginary circles...
They're addressed to a single ring.
Right.
You're correct about that, although we weren't addressing the BSC stent in that previous field. We're addressing the Medtronic AVE stent.
Okay.
I see what you're saying. Troubled by jumping from one to the other.
But you were addressing a stent in which there was everything was disposed in a common cylindrical plane.
Yes.
All right.
But let me... Since we're down this path...
Too many plaintiffs.
I know, I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead.
I would have been happy to have these separated, but here we are. But because it's important, I think I should explain to you that we did not abandon the single ring argument for Boston. For Boston, we had two theories of liability in the first trial. Theory number one was that each ring constituted a tubular member. And as Your Honor observes correctly, each ring is perfectly disposed in the common cylindrical plane, save for the irrelevant little tweak of the weld spot. And so we had that theory number one, and we had theory number two, the stent as a whole. And as to the stent of a whole, we said it was the equivalent.
I'm straight now. With Medtronic, it's the strut and crown problem.
I got to
add
one more thing.
All right, go ahead.
When we tried the retrial, we didn't abandon that theory. We've got those two theories out there. To make the retrial simpler, we decided we would simply try the whole stent and prove the whole stent had a wall surface of substantially uniform thickness, knowing that if we proved that, fortiori, so did each ring. And so, to make the retrial simpler, we tried the whole thing, but you take that verdict together with the verdict from the last case, and we have both theories still in play, if you follow.
I do follow that, but okay, very well.
Okay. Let me touch briefly on the obviousness point that ABE raised. Counsel argued it was a flat-footed charge of pre-KSR law. I think, in fairness, you should look at the charge at 5595. I think it is completely consistent with current law. The charge, which ABE had requested, said, the teachings of different prior art references may only be combined if the prior art as a whole teaches, suggests, or motivates such a combination. A suggestion to combine references may also flow from the nature of the problem, or from the ordinary knowledge of those skilled in the art that certain references are of special importance. I don't think there was anything wrong with that charge when it was given. I don't think there's anything wrong with the charge today. There was no appeal taken. There was no waiver. There's no challenge to that charge because of what they wanted. So I think this issue is waived. Now, there are cases that excuse the failure to object when there's been a fundamental change in the law. There was cases on appeal and Miranda doesn't exist, and now it does exist. Well, you didn't know that, and you might get a pass. Here, these are tiny objections, if any, KSR did not fundamentally change the law, and I think Medtronic is bound by the charge it asked for.
Could you address the prosecution history estoppel arguments that have been made?
Yes, on BMC. Right.
Losing track of the two...
I think so.
Yes,
I will address... Well, I was planning to address the ones Mr. Damaris addressed orally, but I can address all of them as well.
Yeah, if you would. I think it's useful to have them all presented together.
Let me rattle through all of them, and I think that you'll indulge me the time. I'll do it as quickly as I can.
Fine.
The prosecution history estoppel arguments stem from the claim terms smooth and wall surface.
Right.
As to smooth, the district judge found that we were entitled to a range of equivalents for smooth because the rationale for the amendment bore only a tangential relationship to the accused equipment. I think that ruling was correct, and I think there are two other rationales under which we can get to the same result. So there are three arguments on smooth. First, tangential relationship. The question is essentially a factual question, which this court can resolve by looking at the file wrapper. What was the rationale for the amendment? What was the rationale for the argument over IRSA? And we have a difference. We say the rationale for the argument over IRSA was that IRSA was not smooth enough to be delivered intraluminally. We even put in a declaration from a physician that if it had been delivered intraluminally, it would tear the interior vessel wall and would be dangerous. So if, and that's what the district judge found, and if that's correct, and it is, then arguing that IRSIC is not smooth enough to be delivered intraluminally is unrelated to the accused equivalent, Nierstedt, which is smooth enough to be delivered intraluminally. So we win if that is what the rationale was for the amendment. They argue the rationale for the amendment depended on advocating the dictionary definition. That is, they contend that we argued that IRSIC was not smooth in the sense of not being even or level, especially to the touch. And there are exactly two, and based upon that argument, they say if that was the rationale for the distinction, then we can't assert equivalence against the near based on how it feels to the touch. So that's the nub of the dispute between us. There are exactly two references to the dictionary in the file wrapper. One is in the patentee submission, and one is in the, let me see if I can give you the cites for it. And one is in the Andros Declaration. And the two references, both, contrast the definition of smooth with the dictionary definition of rough and say this proves that rough and smooth are antonyms. That's it. There's no argument whatsoever that IRSIC doesn't meet the dictionary definition of smooth. And indeed, on this whole subject of smooth, which the district court adopted as claim construction, the dictionary definition, you know, something that's felt to the touch, you know, isn't really what we're talking about. I mean, you don't feel to the touch a metal device that's inserted in your arteries. So I think that a fair reading of the file wrapper shows that, in fact, we're distinguishing IRSIC as not smooth enough to be delivered intraluminally, and the district judge was right in saying that there's no relationship between that and the accused equivalent near, which is smooth enough to be delivered intraluminally. Reason one. Reason two is some other reason. Standard under Festo. Interesting subject. I don't think this court's ever found an example of Festo's some other reason. Some other reason to allow the equivalent besides tangential relationship. The court has suggested, in pondering what might meet that test, is it might be a circumstance where shortcomings of language drive a fair outcome of granting equivalence. I think this is that case. We submitted the near stent to the patent office with a photograph of the near stent, and an article about the near stent by its designer and inventor, Kobe Richter. The article says, here's the near stent, see its smooth surface. And we cited that as proof of how those of skill in the art understand the term smooth. Now, with the near stent being publicly disclosed by its designer as smooth, it is difficult. Language does not permit a ready, better choice to describe the outer surface of a stent if we mean to have it be broad enough to cover the near. And we think this is a very compelling circumstance in which, what other word would we use? Smooth is how they call it. And indeed, at trial, Dr. Richter testified that the near stent was electro-polished until it was smooth as a baby's face. So we think that's an interesting alternative ground to reach the same result. And the third ground to reach the same result is claim construction itself. The district court adopted a dictionary definition of smooth, even without rough projections, especially to the touch. Respectfully, I don't think that's a sensible definition of the term in the context of this patent. The stent is not touched inside the body, and you can then get engaged in kind of metaphysical discussions. I mean, the witnesses testified that if your finger were tiny enough to run along the bars of the near stent, it would be smooth. Everyone agreed with that, but no one has fingers like that. And so it didn't seem like a sensible claim construction, and the more sensible one was the one that we advocated, which was basically a functional definition without outwardly projecting edges that preclude interluminal delivery. So those are the three arguments with respect to...
What about I'll make sure I get the right plaintiff, BSC's argument about the twisting member and the substantially uniform thickness. This is in the prosecution history distinguishing...
That was never raised as a claim construction argument, and I'm not quite sure what relevance the argument has as it floats through this case. I mean, we had a claim construction which is unchallenged on thickness, and then we had a trial under the claim construction. I don't believe that discussion precludes any particular method of measuring thickness. If it did, it should have been a matter of claim interpretation. It wasn't. They've had a tendency throughout the case of finding random bits from the file wrapper and arguing about them. I think this is in that category. I don't see how it fits into any of the discussions. I certainly don't see it as dictating or precluding any particular method of measurement.
Let me ask you then a different question, which I asked your opposing counsel. With respect to the claim construction, you may have a supplemental observation.
I'm with you.
Okay. The claim construction at 22706 instruction on wall surface. I'm puzzled because this is...
Why it was in the charge?
Yeah.
Oh, that's easy. It was in the charge because there was also a validity challenge.
Okay.
And that's why it was there. All the claim terms were defined so that the jury could assess the validity challenge.
Well, if I had been a juror, I would have assumed from that charge that wall surface was in the case for purposes. It says the tubular member must be disposed in a common cylindrical plane. I would have assumed I have to find that.
There's more to the story.
All right.
The more to the story is we made a motion prior to trial. We had a remand trial on substantially uniform thickness.
Right.
The claim parameter was defined as a standalone definition. Because if you read the definition of substantially uniform thickness that follows, you don't need to know anything about wall surface to understand the definition of substantially uniform thickness. Substantially uniform thickness. The wall of a tubular member must be of largely or approximately uniform thickness. That's the challenge for the jury. That's the assignment.
Well, but that, the combination of the two is what gets me back into that language about the circles.
Okay.
If you put the two together, then the circles discussion.
Well, that's what BSC tried to do,
right,
but they stipulated it away.
Well, I understand that.
That was the cheating. I mean, basically, we had a remand trial. Substantially uniform thickness, the circles, the wall surface is a parameter that's where is the outer surface of the wall disposed. That's
right.
An interesting question. You addressed it in your opinion. The jury in the last case found it was met either literally or by equivalence, and it was not the subject of the retrial. And Boston, and we were concerned that they were going to be trying other claim limitations. We were concerned that they were going to use a limited retrial only on the parameter of substantially uniform thickness to try to relitigate the whole case. And we agreed. Basically, we made a motion to preclude them from re-arguing other claim limitations that weren't in dispute. And in the course of briefing that motion, they agreed and stipulated. They stipulated that the only limitation in dispute was substantially uniform thickness, which, as I say, is a standalone definition. The jury doesn't have to be thinking about metaphorical circles or the wall surface. In the surface, we know is the outer face. The thickness of a wall is an understandable idea. The term was used by this court in redefining the claim limitation. The term was used by the BSC Federal Circuit.
Something that's bothering me is, yes, the jury has to determine the thickness of the wall, but don't they first have to determine what the wall is?
Sure they do. I agree with that.
And were they instructed on that?
The parties litigated about what the wall was.
Did the parties agree on what the wall was?
I would say not entirely.
Which is to say
that their witnesses all tended to agree that the wall of the stent was the metal that made up the stent. Their lawyers tried to recast that as a wall surface argument. But the facts that were in front of the jury on this charge, I mean, no one twisted their arms. You know, where they're.
Well, really, the problem all stems from the fact, I think, that when you speak about the wall surface of a stent, that's not how you would normally describe it. You think of the outside of the stent or the inside, and you think of a wall as a barrier that sits there, and suddenly you're told you've got to decide whether the wall surface of the stent is uniform. And the jury says, what's a wall surface of the stent? We don't know what it is.
The claim language uses the term wall surface. One of skill in the art would recognize what the wall surface is and talk about it as an outer, the outer
one
surface.
One of skill in the art, but not a juror.
But hold on. But one of skill in the art would also understand that that in the context of this patent and its disclosure about measurements, the thickness of the wall surface refers to the thickness of the wall. And that is how the claim was construed by the district court without objection from Boston Scientific. I mean, we had a trial on a standalone claim limitation. They didn't object to that construction. That is a useful correction to the jury about how to decide that parameter. And we had that trial. And during the course of the trial, BSC tried to introduce other elements and claimed they were disputed. And there was a mid-trial correction instruction from the court that there was only one limitation in dispute. They summed up doing exactly the same thing, arguing about the wall surface and steering away from the definition that was before the jury of substantially uniform thickness. And the judge, I believe, properly cut them off. That we had stipulated the other elements were out of play for this case. We had an agreed upon standalone definition, and we litigated a trial on that standalone definition. There was nothing about the standalone definition that would have precluded, that did preclude, because they presented this argument in which they said that the wall, and I want to read it because it seems so odd and unpersuasive, which is why the jury rejected it. They said the thickness of the wall is determined by the radial distance between the outer surface of the struts and an imaginary cylinder inside the tubular membrane. Well, where does that come from? There is nothing in the patent. There's nothing in Judge Bryson's example that warrants an imaginary cylinder on the inside. But that was their case. The jury was entitled to reject that on the very powerful evidence that the thickness of the wall was the thickness of the metal, and that if it varies up and down on the outside, it varies up and down on the inside, and there aren't any substantial deviations. And wall is metal. And that's what those of skill in the art said. That's what the claim construction directed the jury towards. We had a fair trial on a claim limitation that was agreed upon, and the jury came back with, I think, the only verdict the evidence would have supported.
Of course, if that's the wall, I suppose, then the problem, you say it's not a problem because this element wasn't in the case at that point, but the problem is if the wall is the thickness of the metal strut,
mm-hmm.
and the metal strut goes up and down like this, then you no longer have a common cylindrical plane.
Or you have one that's the equivalent of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, here we are into the two parts of the structure. The wall during the ring portion is perfectly flat, and then there's a bump, and then it's perfectly flat, and then there's a bump. And so the DOE question, which is not on appeal, they haven't challenged the sufficiency of the evidence. There was an equivalent of wall surface. That would be the equivalent of disposed in a common cylindrical plane because the deviations overall were so minor, as our testimony was in the first trial. So I think it all, I mean, I realize there's a lot of rat holes to run down to get to the answer.
There are.
Can I do one more estoppel thing, which I skipped over, I think?
Yes, if you would, but we have to wrap it up pretty quickly here. We have
I'll tell you what, I'll rest on my brief on estoppel on wall surface.
Which was the one you would... Well, why don't you give us 30 seconds?
I'll give you 10 seconds.
All right.
10 seconds is you need a clear and unequivocal disavowal, and there was none. The references to common cylindrical plane, no comparable surface in ERSEC, clearly left room between common cylindrical plane and no comparable surface in ERSEC for things that are comparable. And that was what the judge found. She allowed a range of equivalents.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Lastly, I can wrap up with two quick points. Very quick.
On your cross appeal?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you just address the 305 issue, and I think... unless you have something new to tell us about damages.
I'll say one thing on our cross-appeal. Claim 44 should be reinstated. I think it was a clear error. The law is meaningless if you can't make an amendment like this in response to a rejection to distinguish over the prior art. It's a question, I think, of law. This court can look at the file wrapper and conclude what the right answer is. The district court plainly erred. And lastly, I would ask that the court give guidance to the district court on remand. The last time the district court took from the court's reversal without instructions a great deal of uncertainty about what the court should do, and that uncertainty was exacerbated by the fact that we had asked this court to direct the district court to reinstate the verdicts, and she concluded from the fact that she hadn't done that, that in the end that she was supposed to grant a retrial on the infringement, which I think was wholly unnecessary and cost us many years while the patent expired. I think that it's time to bring these cases to an end, and that whatever issues they may have on the damages case can be appealed to this court. I don't believe there's any time for more proceedings in the district court on damage issues, all of which could have been raised in the first trial in 2000. I would hope and request the court to consider giving some clear guidance.
I think we've already established that courts of appeals can get themselves into trouble by saying too much, and so I'm not sure how welcome your invitation is, given the context.
Well, then just
but, I understand.
A strong hint would be helpful.
I understand. Very well. Why don't we hear from the appellants on rebuttal?
Your Honor, I do agree with Mr. Discant, and maybe we can reach agreement here that it is time to end the case, and we would ask the court to grant us JMOL. Yeah.
I think everybody wants to end the case in their favor.
Exactly. And what I would like to address, because I think it is case dispositive on that issue, is are we talking about a question of fact or are we talking about a question of law? Mr. Discant has said that the experts dueled and the jury must have accepted the idea about, you know, how one was supposed to measure. This was not a factual question, and I do not want to get overly hung up with the imaginary circles and is it binding or is it, you know, dispositive or is it an analogy or whatever. What is important in AVE 1 is the statement by the court that the substantially uniform limitation requires that the thickness of the wall surface be sufficiently uniform along its length and between members to allow uniform expansion. It is clear from the actual claim language that the substantially uniform thickness has to be along the length of the stent. It must be. We have an absolute concession from the other side that the evidence is undisputed that the wall of the stent runs from the outermost point of the crown to the outermost point of the crown. That's in the blue brief at 32. I don't really see an argument on the other side. Once we know that it goes from one end to the other end, the question is it of substantially uniform thickness? And the only way there can be an answer that says, yes, it is if we ignore the crown area. Now, there's two arguments from the other side on how to ignore it. One of them is it's too small, we just can't worry about that. In addition to the Lazarus point, I just want to make the point that from a clinical perspective, it's huge. These stents glide through the arteries. You know, because they are built in a completely different way such that they have this taper on the front end. We were able to get in some of our clinical evidence. The judge shut us down on certain other clinical evidence that we wanted to put in. But there's substantial evidence in the record to show the clinical benefits that this taper provides. Second problem with Cordes's argument is that if you take it to its logical conclusion, then there's no way, you can have a stent that goes to a tapered point over a distance of 3 inches. And from Cordes's argument, they'd look at that and they'd say, well, you know, you don't count that, or I don't know what they would say. But they would look at something where it tapers over 3 inches to a point and they would say, yeah, that's a substantially uniform thickness. That could not have been what this court meant in AVE1. And without getting hung up on imaginary circles or anything else, what this court said in AVE1 was, what do you measure? It doesn't tell you how you measure. It doesn't tell you whether you use calipers or a scanning electron microscope. It doesn't say that engineers in the industry do it this way or anything else. It's a claim construction issue of what do you measure. And this court, over and over and over again, has said, where you have undisputed structure, the infringement analysis is claim construction. In the MyMail case that I cited before, the court said because there's no dispute regarding the operation of the accused systems, that issue reduces to a question of claim interpretation and is amenable to summary judgment. And there they affirmed summary judgment of non-infringement. There's at least six other cases. One of them is that...
We're familiar with that
okay.
line of cases.
And Your Honor, the standard for summary judgment is exactly the same for JMOL, Third Circuit case on it, 297 F3rd 294.
These aren't the law on this is not in dispute. I think.
Right, and so therefore, Your Honor, it does collapse to a question of law. This is an issue that never should have gone to the jury. This is a legal question.
You had initially taken, I think. 1 minute, and we've given you three. Do you have one quick point to conclude with?
I do, Your Honor. In AVE1, the only issue before the court was with respect to the struts, the internal straight segments. Okay, that is the way it was briefed, and I would refer the court to the first appellate brief, which is in the appendix at 33747. And that is the only thing that the court addressed. The court was asked to look at the cross-section and the strut area.
Right.
The court never considered whether as you move out along the length of the stent and you get to the crown, is that substantially uniform thickness or not.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Kisner?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Just a few brief points. On the substantially uniform thickness, I can't emphasize enough that the theory they're pursuing now and the theory they pursued with the jury was disclaimed during the prosecution history. When they distinguished ERSEC, which is this folding piece of metal that they fold into a cylinder when the struts pop out of the cylindrical plane, they told the patent office struts twisting out of the common cylindrical plane is the antithesis of substantially uniform thickness. Now they're trying to run from that. We did raise that below. We raised it in the court, and we asked the judge not to let them pursue this theory. We raised it in the JMALs, and the judge denied holding them to the prosecution history. But if you just look at what they said at A2051 and at A2045, they disclaimed this theory, and they shouldn't be allowed to say it. They shouldn't be allowed to measure the metal along a bumpy path from end to end on the cylinder. Why did we even get into this trouble? We got into this trouble because at the first trial, the court let wall surface go to the jury under doctrine of equivalence. There's no way the jury would have found our bumpy terrain across the end to end of that cylinder to be literal on wall surface. This is not a literal infringement case. They didn't even address the legal conundrum, which is against this court's precedent, which is the court found that wall surface should be limited based on prosecution statements. That's a prosecution disclaimer, and the judge read wall surface to be in a common cylindrical plane. That comes from their words to the examiner. And they don't challenge that. They're not appealing that. Once the district court finds that, it is exactly the same standard that blocks doctrine of equivalence. Prosecution disclaimer and estoppel argument, estoppel, are the same legal test. And once it gets into the literal claim, you cannot let DOE vitiate that term in the construction. And even the theory they pursued on the individual C elements, if they want to argue those are the two real numbers, I mentioned in my opening comments why they can't, because even the ring portion in the patent is not elongated, and they call it a part of the tubular member. But even if they did, they can't get infringement there either. What was proved below, and this is at A29175 and A29177, are the welds that seal. When you roll up our stent, you have to weld it. The welds are bigger than the stent members. Their own expert at trial said, in comparison to the strut thickness, the welds are huge. And this is in our brief, and the site's in our brief. So even if you pursue the tubular member as that individual C-section, they can't get literal infringement on that either. So even at that first trial, even if you go with the small piece, there's not literal infringement of wall surface because the welds are bigger than the stent members. And the claim requires thickness of the wall surface, not wall, not strut, wall surface. And the jury was at C in the second trial because of this conundrum on doctrine of equivalence. Let me just comment on smooth surface because they mentioned that, and I didn't mention that in my opening. This is an even stronger case than everything we've spoken about so far for prosecution estoppel. Here we have amendment estoppel, and there's no dispute about that. Smooth surface is in the patent claims because in the prosecution history they said ERSEC isn't smooth. They said it wasn't smooth because the members twist out of the cylindrical surface. And if you look at their prosecution history on exactly this issue, you can see that A...